Hello, I guess bloggies, people who read my blog for some inexplicable reason. We're doing something a bit different today. Normally I use my blog to showcase like big media works and whatnot, like, hey, check out this thing you might not have seen, or look up this criticism of how your favorite movie is racist or something like that. And that kind of stuff I love doing. But today I wanted to bring forward some work that's like happening and being made and I think is super cool, which is the creative work of my friend Eric the Beric here, for his upcoming Forge in the Dark game, I guess you'd call it Anarchism and Up, Brinkwood, The Blood of Tyrants. Yes,
exactly. Thanks, Talon. And just to give the listeners a taste, Brinkwood's four-word description, is Robin Hood versus Vampires. It's set in kind of a Castlevania-esque setting where you're a bunch of brigands, murderers, thieves, rebels, who are out to kind of overthrow the vampiric oligarchy that has conquered your nation, conquers your world, and hopefully restore some measure of freedom and independence and liberty to yourself, your countrymen, and possibly the world.
Yeah. Now, I already have gone on the record multiple times that I think the Forge in the Dark system is really good for kind of a cinematic fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants, strong on emotions, good on narrative impact kind of system. I love it to bits. I'm very big on it. And I think this will make... I think Brinkwood will technically be my third purchased system. And to disclose, I'm backing this Kickstarter. I think that this game looks sick as hell. I love what he's been doing. I've been tuning into the various live streams. I am a fan of Brinkwood.
You are possibly our biggest fan, and yeah. I thank you for that.
Well, I got to get to the top of the leaderboard somehow.
Exactly. Got to put up those numbers.
Yeah. How else does fandom work?
Mm-hmm. It's a competition.
Absolutely. I didn't come here to make friends. I came here to win.
Exactly. This is core to my identity, and I'm going to defend it with my life.
So, ostensibly, there is the we could do the obligatory marketing speak about what Brinkwood is and how to play it and whatnot, but that all stuff's all on the Kickstarter page.
Right.
And broadly speaking, if you know what Forge in the Dark is, you already kind of got a handle on that already. Mm-hmm. So what I would want to talk about is stuff that... about the assumptions of the setting, the stuff that builds into why the world is the way it is and why players get to do the things that they get to do. Because you've used some words in the description of this series, in the description of this game world a couple of times, which I think are like the kind of thing that I would like bring up in front of a class with a lecture slide. Like, okay, we're going to talk about this.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is a big thing. There's a John Mulaney bit, I think, where he says that the word the phrase "there's a lot to unpack here" is the academic version of yikes. And when I say that, I'm not implying yikes, but I am saying there's just a lot to unpack, especially in the term castle punk.
Right.
So after you.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a bit. Just a quick funny anecdote. I've used the term so much. That I initially, when I was setting up the Kickstarter, I forgot to define it, and someone had to come along and like look at it and be like, "Hey, you keep using this word castle punk, and it's not an accepted term. I can't look it up anywhere. What the fuck? What the hell does this mean? What are you talking about?" And I was like, "Oh, that's right. I didn't make it up, but like, I'm popularizing it, I guess." And so the term's origins are this idea of a setting that is similar in aesthetic to the Castlevania series of video games, of anime. This idea of a game that is set in kind of a very gothic aesthetic, an aesthetic that is kind of rooted in medievalism and gothic architecture and, to a certain extent, gothic story tropes. But at the same time, it is not very concerned with historical accuracy and, in fact, embraces anachronism to the point where, ostensibly this is a feudal society, but, there are factories that, run on some primitive form of steam power or, water mill power. We have, like, not quite robots, but we have like fusions of mechanics and magic in our various monstrosities and monsters roaming about. So, you know, it gets to this idea of the castle is both something that is ahistorical and also, you know, aesthetic. But the more important part is the second half, which is punk. Punk oftentimes kind of gets derided as, oh, everything is punk these days, you know, steampunk, cyberpunk, you know, whale punk. And it's just kind of this.
We'll get into a fight on that one another time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, maybe Dishonored is more punk than I realize. In fact, it probably is.
Corvo's a cop. All right. I love Dishonored a lot. I love the setting. I'm happy to talk about how much I love it, but please, let's all accept and hold it to our hearts. Corvo's a cop.
It hurts, but it is true. So the punk side of that, what it means to me and what I really want to focus on is the idea that in other kind of gothic-themed games, you are kind of there to just kind of wallow in, I wouldn't say the misery, but like the dramatic sadness of it all, you know, that you're there to kind of soliloquize about the depths of your own depravity or, you know, drink the blood of virgins under the moonlight.
And there is just a fantastically deep irony there in that essentially what you're describing is what would normally be described as romantic fiction. And the thing is, they hated the Gothic movement.
Right, it's all Byron, right? You know,
yeah, it's basically what if we have read exactly one book and drunk exactly one beer. It is a very, very basic vision of literary history. And it's almost like the stuff that's like good for counterculture gets quietly kind of shuffled to the side. Again, weird. Anyway, go on.
Right, yeah. So I want to lean more into the idea that you are essentially outsiders breaking into this genre. You are bringing a punk lens and a punk intensity and a punk intention to this scenario. You know, you aren't here to prop up the system. You aren't here to replicate the system. You are not, you know, this isn't cyberpunk or what is it, Shadowrun, where the highest thing you can aspire to be is to become another Mr. Johnson. You are here to literally tear down the oppressive structures that hold you and other people down. And it is possible to build something better. Because unfortunately, in a lot of revolutionary fiction, especially recently, people kind of love the trope. I mean, creators. Obviously, people don't love it because people have embraced Brinkwood. Some creators rely heavily on the trope that no matter what you do, you're just going to kind of replicate the systems that you were trying to fight against. You know, you will become the monster. You will, it's the idea that, you know, marginalized people, if they gained power, they would treat us just as bad as we treated them, don't you know?
Which is the racism that lies at the heart of a lot of these, the notion that empire itself is not only self-sustaining, but the natural outcome, which is, again, one of those things. I think the essay is called Invisible Bullets. There is a disarming in culture of the idea of revolution itself, the idea that, for example, violence has a place or a purpose in this complex conversation about how do we make things better. And that's because it's very easy to make essentially anti-hope media. Where, you know, well, what if we do a revolution and then wind up just as bad? What if at the end of the story you just wind up exactly where you started? That all may... And that's what we tend to view as, like, serious fiction, right? Like, that's the stuff I know for myself, growing up, it was like, oh my goodness, my mind is blown.
But you're a silly idealist if you believe anything else.
And that's why we should all become good Reaganites. Let's face it, as a child of the 80s, that absolutely is a factor.
It's this real cognitive dissonance just growing up in America, because in all of our history books is the American Revolution. And, like, we don't try and pretend that was nonviolent. I mean, you know, we might not go quite into, you know, the horrors of the Revolutionary War as much, but, like, we don't pretend it wasn't a war. We don't pretend, like, you know, we didn't fight off a colonial regime. But it's kind of the end of history thing where we kind of, like, say, and now we don't need to fight ever again, except the Civil War.
And that was really a big mistake anyway.
And that was really a big mistake, you know.
It's about tariffs,
it was a big, terrible misunderstanding, really. Don't think about it. Don't look at those statues over there. Don't worry about it. Yeah, so on the one hand, you know, we have all this history and we have all these ideas of our own self-concept that are wrapped up in the idea of a violent overthrow of the government. But at the same time, the very same people that are like, oh, you know, we need to be ready at a moment's notice to take up our guns and, you know, tear down a fascist government are the very same people, you know, we see today that are propping up said fascist government. So the propaganda has worked. The cognitive dissonance is in full swing.
Yeah. And I guess the secondary point is, how do you feel about creators who put their politics in games?
I mean, you're going to do it no matter what. The question is, how honest do you want to be about it? And whether or not you realize that the Overton window is a thing. Because people will say they're unpolitical, and they will say, oh, there's no politics in my game. And really what that usually means is that my politics are in line with the current Overton window that I have deemed acceptable, and is deemed acceptable in, you know, my majority culture. And therefore, I don't have to interrogate how my positions, you know, prop up the systems of power. And you know, wealth and inequality,
and that's where you get that same similar situation of sorry, that's where you get that same situation you just described, where the lack of interrogation means that everything gets to be, again, the invisible ink gets to be just like the structure around the basic assumptions of what actually counts as happening.
Right. The non-political is the politics of the default.
Yeah. And in many cases is jovially embracing that while pretending it doesn't, which is even more like sinister and Weasley and pathetic.
Yeah, exactly.
So when it comes to this idea of Castle Punk, it sounds like you're doing this from a very top-down perspective, where you are saying, all right, I'm not going to say like Game of Thrones style, all right, the winter happens like this, so these buildings need to be reinforced like this, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
You're instead coming out from the top down. It's like, I want a giant, craggy, Duckula-style castle that is itself a character in the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
How do I shape... What does that mean for the world? And this is something I think that, like, even if I didn't already massively agree with you and like your work and like the style of Brinkwood and like all sorts of stuff going on here, this is the thing that I would normally be bringing forward when people were asking for suggestions for interesting ideas in tabletop. Because essentially what you're doing is you are in ironically, in a very gothic way, literally a gothic way, you are treating the landscape as if it is a character to the narrative.
Right.
Which is like, literally, that's what the grotesques were. That's what the whole point of, like, you put a characterization on the building itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that the building has the threat to it. There is an actual danger implied by the object that is the castle.
Right. There is malevolence to the very, you know, stones that hold up the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And with that comes this in turn, you know, oft-repeated phrase of, like, these things are being done by people with names and addresses. This is not just something... this is not just a hypothetical world where things are bad, in the context of... And let's... I'm not wanting to get into the big D&D discussion, but just, like, to bring up one D&D setting that I think we are reasonably on the same page on, in the Forgotten Realms.
Yeah.
I don't know who runs the Red Wizards of Thay.
Mm-hmm.
But we are all aware, as players, that the Red Wizards of Thay are generically bad, evil wizards who run a country where slavery is legal.
Right.
And that setting doesn't feel a need to explain that in terms of economics and systems, and indeed, why the countries next door haven't annihilated them. But, you know,
because then it wouldn't exist as a fun place to play in, or because then the players wouldn't get to tear it down, or the players wouldn't get to do X or Y. Comes down to the real reason of, like, game design. But
and, like, I would buy the point. Players wouldn't get to argument if it wasn't for the fact that every single time I've seen Thay brought up in any of these conversations about the Forgotten Realms. It's always in the layer like, well, you can't really get rid of it. Like, not right. really. Like, mm-hmm. what's the point? I thought Dungeons & Dragons was a stupid power fantasy simulator, and you're not giving me the stupid power fantasy of murdering slavers. You bungholes.
You know, while we're ragging on D&D, I have to bring up... we get a lot of converts from Curse of Strahd and Ravenloft.
Yes!
As a setting. Because people will come and they'll say, okay, you know, my players have played through Curse of Strahd or they've played through Ravenloft, and they've figured out the trick that you can't get rid of Ravenloft. You know, you can't really get rid of Strahd because, like, there are fundamental evil eldritch beings that will shape reality back into the horribleness that is Barovia, essentially no matter what you do. And so they come to Brinkwood, basically, and, like, port their games of Curse of Strahd over to Brinkwood so that they have the opportunity to play a game that actually moves beyond, you know, Barovia will always be terrible, there is no win state, there is no victory, you just, you know, it's constant misery, and then you leave and you move on to the next D&D module or something.
Yeah. Strahd, the Curse of Strahd is also, apparently, the Ravenloft setting in general is something beloved by a current crop of reactionaries who have tried to basically infest that area of D&D with their own stances, because then they can say, oh, we're traditionalists. We just love the way things used to be with the... I even feel uncomfortable just saying the word Vistani. Just because I'm like, I don't know it's if not that's good. A slur.
that's like, how far it's gotten us, is we don't even know, you know.
Yeah.
What's the quiet part and what's the loud part?
Yeah, and the cultural context, and for anyone who's not familiar, in the Ravenloft setting, there is a group of, I believe the polite term to use would be traveler people, who are very much modeled on stereotypes down to the evil eye and an economy based on turnips. Of what Gary Gygax thought actual traveler people were like, and they have the name Vistani, which, because of the way Gygax got a lot of his ideas, we're not entirely sure if it's actually like a secret double plus underscored slur.
Right, yeah, if there's triple parentheses around it somewhere.
It's really just that we can't give it the benefit of the doubt. That's the real horror of Dungeons & Dragons at this point.
You can't give anything the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem. I mean, they've talked about fixing it, but they've talked about fixing a lot of things for a while. So Brinkwood does essentially offer a break from that, and it does offer a break from that particular segment of the Curse of Strahd community that is kind of this, basically, you know, fascists have thought they have found a place to be comfortable in. And I want to say there are a lot of great Curse of Strahd players. There are a lot of great Curse of Strahd streamers. Whenever I criticize a D&D product, whenever I criticize Wizards of the Coast, I'm not criticizing individuals. I'm criticizing the systems that produce these outcomes. And in a lot of ways, it is to the credit of so many people that they have pulled something useful out of Curse of Strahd, and to a credit of a lot of self-serving to myself, that a lot of them have realized, wait, you know, I can still do this. I can still have the fun part of this without all of the baggage and the kind of despair inherent in the D&D setting, just by, you know, porting it over to something else. In this case, you know, Brinkwood, or, you know, even just default Blades of the Dark.
Yeah. One of my favorite, like, subtle, like, if this had been done as a deliberate point in a narrative, you'd go, that's a bit on the nose, but like, the monster that keeps Strahd forever chained and unable to be healed and unable to address the problem, the fact that you can't kill the monster for good in that setting, the beast that is keeping that going is literally capitalism.
Right.
Like, Strahd is too important to brand identity for them to ever actually kill him off.
Yeah.
And at that point, he's literally being animated by capitalism, which is, again, if I said that in a story, you'd be like, try harder? Just a little harder?
Yeah, it's a little much. It's a little on the nose. Yeah, I think, you know, there is something to be said for, like, a setting that you can return to again and again, you know, over the course of generations. You know, people talk about Dark Sun, you know, playing Dark Suns with their kids, playing Dark Suns, you know, back when they were kids. you know, these settings that have this history to them. And that's nice, but, you know,
yeah.
In every other role-playing game, you're able to end the role-playing game with "we won" or "we changed something." But, yeah. And I guess technically, like, I don't think, you know, Chris Perkins is going to kick down your door if you kill Strahd for good. But, like, the book is so... The book and the universe and everything is kind of set up against that, and the lore is set up against that as an outcome, which I think rubs a lot of people the wrong way.
Yeah, and, like, on the one hand, there is that way that Dungeons & Dragons is, like, every game is your game, and that's great, and that's really cool, but also because of the nature of brand recognition and the capitalism that drives this particular wing of role-playing games, it yeah. does mean... Like, on the one hand, you do have the fact that no one can do what Wizards does, except Wizards. You need to be a Wizards-scale business to do right. things. Like, we are going to roll out a campaign that literally everyone in the world can sit down and play in a reasonable fashion, and we can take data from all of that and aggregate yeah. it together and make... Like, no one has that scale. Yeah, that sucks.
No one has a successful business called Magic the Gathering propping up their... decaying and calcifying industry for 10 years until Critical Role comes along. So yeah, there are things that Wizards does and thing Wizards, you know, legitimately advances for the hobby just by virtue of who they are and what they have available to them.
Yeah, and like I'm not sitting here trying to rubbish on Wizards of the Coast, though I do think it's very important, especially in light of I'm going to get their name wrong, Orion?
Orion Black, yeah. formerly known DC Dungeon Commander, yeah.
Yeah, Orion Black, I, like, as a Magic content creator myself, I do try and make sure that I, like, I mentioned it in the last couple of times I've written about Magic, I think, or maybe just the last time, but basically, like, hey, you should go check out this stuff that happened to Orion, I'm gonna link that, and I will link that in the text for this one.
It's an important but story, just, like, definitely.
It's an important story, especially because it serves us well to not let the fact that it happened vanish into memory, and we go back to thinking of Wizards are one of the good ones. Because I resist the idea that Wizards are the evil empire. They just are a little evil empire-y, which, you know doesn't... You know, it's a complicated relationship in my head. But the point is that, like, even I, someone who is generally in favor of a lot of stuff Dungeons & Dragons does,
right.
very much want to make sure that this does not get memory hold.
Yeah, yeah, this exactly.
is a big deal.
But
yes, so on to murdering fascist vampires.
Right, right. Not just complaining.
to be fair, how often do we actually get to call each other up and just go like, man, I'm so annoyed by this?
we're both, like, such fundamentally angry people, I feel like.
Yes.
That, and, like, we both don't get to vent that as much as we like to. So, because we both have this kind of niceness that we usually embrace.
Well, and we also have we've also got the examples around us of the kind of guys, specifically men
right.
in nerd spaces, who wield their anger like it is justification for itself.
Right,
and
exactly.
I want to be one of those guys.
Yeah, yeah. There aren't very many positive role models of anger in our spaces. So, but everyone now and again, it's good to get angry.
You know what's a really good role model for anger? In Brinkwood. There is so like, joking aside, actually I wanted to talk about this because, like, PhD research talking about games as culture, one of the things I constantly come back to is that games are a way to practice emotional states. Part of what Johann Huizinga in the book Homo Ludens, which just your brief historical background around that one. On the one hand, it has concepts in it like the magic circle, and it talks about the idea that play is fundamental to culture, and that means that not everything that has not everything we think of as human is necessarily cultured, which means, like, wolves have culture and birds have culture because they play games. That's kind of good. On the other hand, dude in question, massive colonial apologist and loved the Dutch Empire. On the other hand, the Nazis hated him, so, you know, but in that
The magic circle is a land of contrasts.
Yes. This is why I tend to go back to Bernard Suits, Bernard Suits, whose stance is much more the best circle is communism, actually. And exactly the kind of communism you believe in.
Right, yeah, whichever it happens to be.
But in the idea of practicing emotional states, games give us ways to envision the world as we want it to be, and it lets us literally play with those ideas. Mm-hmm. And this idea that you can't change the Curse of Strahd is one of those ways that that idea of what does the world look like when the capitalism vampire is gone, what does that even look like? What do we do? How does the world work when we get there? And that's one of those things that in games like Brinkwood are quietly, literally revolutionary. Like, I don't mean to say, like, buy this game or you're a bad comrade, but I do mean that the idea of getting people into the headspace of, oh, these can be addressed, and getting into the emotional feeling of being willing to change the world, as opposed to, well, there was a bad king, and then we replaced them with a good king, and now the kingness continues, which is the way a lot of fantasy games and a lot of fantasy drama scenarios build themselves.
Yeah, yeah, it's, you know, we got rid of that nasty Cromwell, now we're back on track.
Don't make me come out for Cromwell, God.
I was going to say, he was a good person. But yeah, it's interesting because, like, and a lot of the times when you talk about, like, the practice of play and what you get to practice, it's really interesting to me sometimes the lessons people take away from it and the lessons people that kind of evolve through play. My favorite example is, within the game, you know, you have to make decisions about what to do, right? On a very basic level, you need to be like, okay, where do we go? You know, like, that's a question that gets asked almost at the start of every session. And I've got a bunch of stuff that, you know, the GM can do to try and guide that discussion. I think at one point my character stopped and they're like, wait a second. Why don't we just go and ask people what they need? You know, why don't we just go to, okay, so we know we need to go to this town, and we know this town is, like, kind of leaning towards us, and we want them to help us, and we want them to join the rebellion. You know, rather than trying to guess what's going to help them, why don't we just go there and ask? And it was this really, like, cool moment, because I was like, yes, yes. And, like, they went there, and they just, like, kind of hung out for a while, and just, they brought, like, food, and they almost did, like, a food's not bombs thing, where they knew the place didn't have a lot of good food, so they brought food, and they handed it out, and they talked to people, and they listened to people, you know, having conversations, or just talking about their daily lives. And they also, like, hosted essentially an open mic at the local tavern, where people could, like, come up and, like, tell stories, and, like, sing songs. Many of which the vampires had kind of discouraged from being sung because, you know, they're from an older culture, they're from an older religion, they're not in keeping with the modern ethos. And by virtue of interacting with people in a very direct way and in a very, like, tangible way, they were able to draw out a lot more of the story and be involved much more directly within the telling of the story. Like, rather than me just going, like, okay, yeah, they need you to go out and get, what, five bear pelts or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Not that you would ever do that in a role-playing game, but yeah, the idea that they interacted with people and it was a give and take of, like, you know, the questions they asked informs the answers that were given, you know, and the way the questions were asked of, like, you know, what do you need to survive to the next winter? What do you need? What would it take for you to join a rebellion? Who's stopping you from, you know, taking up arms? You know, what happens to, you know, like, who would punish you if you were left defenseless and things like that. And once you get into the habit of, like, asking pointed questions, both from a game perspective that points you directly where you need to go from a game perspective and a mechanical perspective, but it also teaches a very important lesson, I think, about organizing just in general. Because in all my organizing experience, that is one of the biggest issues is, sometimes people will come to places or communities and they will try to impose what they think a community needs, whereas the more successful and the more productive thing a lot of the time is to go and ask and to listen, and then from there to provide.
Yeah. That is incredibly cool. There is a connected thing there, which is, all right, okay, you've got this idea, now systematize it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the context of a Forge of the Dark game, one of the things about the Forge of the Dark games that I generally hold up as like one of the high watermarks of them is that these books are usually extremely good at creating effectively like little scenario engines where they're like little idea factories that are absolutely crammed to the gills with, you know, factions that interact with one another and ideologies that are at war with one another and all these different demanding and competing needs. Mm-hmm. When you say that, like, the funny thing is that you describe this idea of going to a community and asking them, hey, what do you need? What's your problem in this context? That creates this really, like, almost, it reminds me of Leverage, of all things.
Right,
where
yeah.
Where there's this context of like, okay, I just have to know what really actually happens in this space. And as a direct result, people get radicalized of learning that, oh no, that really happens.
Yeah.
And so the scenario construction tools that you're going to have building in Brinkwood are going to be drawing on this genuine knowledge about, you know, what does a community that fears look like? What do they need? That's mm-hmm. super interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of our work is in that space of, essentially trying to figure out how to communicate that to players and keep that, like you said, that idea engine going. Because that's a really cool thing in Blades in the Dark. And I think our world designer, Brian Yaksha, who's done most of our generators and has done a lot of the connective tissue of things, like everything references something else, you know, every line, every hook, you know, mentions a faction or a different place. And like, you know, if you were to put it all up in an idea web, you know, everything would be connected somehow, and everything is going to lead you to something else, and everything's going to kind of point you to this idea. Another really important theme that I think is kind of tangentially related is, and another important lesson that my players learned alongside me, is that we can't just kill a vampire and expect the problem to be finished, right? There will always be another vampire. There will always be, you know, some other horrible person that will step into that place, unless we radically change the system or give people the tools to defend themselves from oppression. So, you know, I mean, I just ragged on Curse of Strahd for, like, not letting you kill Strahd. But, you know, in my game, yeah, you can kill Strahd, but unless, you know, you arm the townsfolk and the villagers and, like, you know, inspire them to rise up and take democratic control of the means of production, you know, there is going to be some sort of backlash, whether it comes from a different vampire, you know, locally, or a different vampire internationally.
Yeah. And in that regards, you get back to that idea of the self-sustaining empire. Like, the whole point of the only thing empire is interested in it is the continued propagation of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
So that value overwhelms everything else. Everything else is just window dressing.
Right, right.
And in that regard, you wind up with a situation where you have a culture that that essentially is full of these self-perpetuating engines, just waiting for them to kick in and tick over the second something goes wrong, which is indeed one of the things, like police services ostensibly are there to maintain public safety, but overwhelmingly we know that they are there to propagate and maintain, you know, the existing power structure.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because so in Default Blades in the Dark, as I'm sure you're aware, you have this idea of the wanted levels, right? And as they rise up, like, the entanglements, the problems for the crew get more and more intense, with the idea being that the city is reacting to your notoriety. We have a similar idea in the idea of tyranny, that more and more of the veneer, like, as you become a bigger and bigger problem, a bigger and bigger threat to the empire and to the regime, more and more of the niceties get stripped away. More and more of the veneer comes off, the mask slips, and they just...
Oh, I like that.
It expresses itself not only in a problem for you, but in kind of a problem for, you know, the society you're trying to aid. Because, like, it's not that they weren't being vicious before, but now they're not even pretending to hide it. Now they're not even pretending there's a choice or there's a better way, or that, you know, you have any hope. Which, you know, maybe materially isn't that big a difference, but I think for a population can be very psychologically damaging.
It is, as noted, one of those main things that's actually super important. Speaking as someone from a colonial outcropping, like in Australia, one of the things during the Depression that like happened in a very material way to us, and I'm saying this is like we were white. This is a pocket of the empire that Britain owned, and this wasn't like revolution. This was just the service of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
But during the Great Depression, England, because they were hurting for money, sent out, I kid you not, an actual banker to Australia to redo our books, to make sure that we could pay off our debts to England.
Yeah, so early World Bank, essentially.
Yeah, very, very much in that same situation, and it included these. And you look at it in hindsight, and it's like, good gracious, how do you even imagine talking mm-hmm. to people like this, with things like, it just means that the average Australian needs to stop eating so much. It's like, I'm sorry?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's that same, it is the idea of facades and masks, mm-hmm. which neatly segues into another thing I think that's really cool about Brinkwood, and I'd like to give you a chance to talk about a touch. So, ostensibly, in horror, monsters are things to represent things, which, you know, I know that's a very empty phrase, but like your typical, your werewolf is the fear of the stranger who comes to town. Mm-hmm. The owlbear is the don't go into the forest, things are spoopy out there kind of fear. Mm-hmm. Like every monster we use, and I've like mentioned, dragons are surrogate governments.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only thing that ever topples them is another legitimate source of power. Like yeah. you never hear of a peasant's uprising against a dragon, which would be sick.
Some people talk about them like they're natural disasters too, is how I've heard them
yes.
described.
Yeah, that's a very good one as well. But like when you think about when a dragon dies, it's yeah. like at the behest of the true heir of the throne or a knight. Like right. those are the two most common sources of your dragon disposal.
Right, and that implies something about how you see legitimate authority and the legitimate use of force, right?
Exactly. Like, who is allowed to do violence? And in that regard, you have, in Brinkwood, you have these two different, effectively, monsters. It's just that one of them is monsters bad, and one of them is the monstrous we become, which is the masks and the vampires.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, in your own terms, I'm not asking you to, like, hey, come around to my thesis in that I've literally just sprung on you.
Yeah.
But it seems to me, as a storyteller, you have the option then to directly juxtapose a violent vampire with a user of the mask of violence and show that it is not the principle that is the same. It's not the monstrous trait, but rather the monstrous person
mm-hmm.
that works between them. So would you like to talk for a little bit about the masks, which are definitely one of the things I like the most about the setting?
Sure. And to keep on kind of the brand of this interview, I'm not going to go into the mechanics of the mask, even though I do think they are
Please.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And they are, I'll just say, the unique thing about it is that Blades in the Dark, usually you have essentially all of your character stuff, and then you have all of your special, like, playbook stuff, and it's all on the same sheet, and you have to play it forever, and a lot of people get bored with it and kill their characters.
Or alt heavily in the case of my groups.
Yeah, exactly. In Brinkwood, what you can essentially do is, you can keep your character, you can play them from session to session, and they'll advance and they'll grow. But they also have these masks that will kind of grow alongside them, and they can switch in and out of, and they can trade between each other so that you're not always stuck in the same role or stuck with the same mechanics. So back to your actual question and the one I'm more interested in, which is kind of what
and
do
I, the... I'm not going to sit here and just hype up the coolest thing I've seen masks used for, because I've seen some... You've picked some good players over there. Is it the San Gennaro?
San Gennaro.
Is that how you pronounce
it? Yeah.
San Gennaro. Yeah, you've got some real... Yeah, I love the drama. Anyway,
yeah,
go on.
I love them a lot, too. I think kind of the metaphor that gets used, or kind of the idea that we're driving at with kind of the naming of the masks and the theming of the masks, because we use names like violence and torment and riot and terror... And, you know, I will admit I'm a little edgy about it. You know, it's a little edgy to be like, no, man, terror is all about how you use it. You know, like,
yeah,
you can make a pretty solid argument that, yeah, a riot is the language of the unheard, and there is such a good thing as a good riot. And there is such a good thing as, you know, for lack of a better word, good violence. And I think the mechanical design of the masks is meant to provide that juxtaposition and to suggest it to the player. Because to take the example of the Mask of Violence, you don't get credit for using the Mask of Violence to hurt people, even bad people, even vampires. Like, you don't get any XP, you know, you don't get any mechanical reward out of it. You know, it might solve a problem. It might only solve a problem temporarily. What you get rewarded for is using violence to defend people, is using it to protect your allies and your comrades. I kind of explicitly list that, like, violence is primarily concerned with defense. Like, it because the masks have their own personalities, you know, depending on who's GMing them and all that. But some of the suggested personalities are, I want to lean into the idea of kind of like the protective older brother or older sister, you know, like that's Mask's relationship to its siblings. That's kind of the whole thing of that the masks are meant to kind of in some ways mirror the vampires and in some ways provoke thoughts in the players about what it means to use tools effectively. And what is the best use of tools that you might not have usually considered? Because in a lot of revolutionary fiction, and I think in a lot of revolutionary thought, the biggest hurdle is convincing people that the thing they have been taught is bad and that they should never do and they should never use is something that has value and should be considered from a more materialist and realistic perspective. That, like, you know, I've been taught from day one, you know, violence is always bad. There is no cause for violence unless a police officer is doing it to someone, you know?
Yeah, and that there is your classic monopolization of violence, which is
exactly, you
know, the whole thing.
And it's the monopolization of these forces of terror, of torment, of violence, of riot that kind of is what you are breaking by putting on these masks. Because the whole thing is anyone can put on a mask. All you need to do is commit.
And this is that idea of basic assumptions, this invisible ink. Like, what have we lost in the names of compliance?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So this is all super interesting and extremely cool. And like, obviously, this is still also a game. Like,
right.
I've watched it being played, and it is absolutely rollicking fun.
Mm-hmm.
Not to turn this into, like, a greatest hits thing, but just off one session, I very strongly remember watching you with the co-op play, you with the co-op, last year, remember the co-op, I don't know why I made that distinction, but I'm afraid I do not know people by their names, but I do remember one player looking directly, like, barreling the camera and saying, sorry, mama, I'm a player character, and I fell out of my chair.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
just such a perfect line for a perfect moment. also, with this idea of transformative violence, in that very game, there's a moment where a player basically dived on a bomb, Captain America it,
mm-hmm.
and their negotiation to get out of it, the thing they came up with to save themselves, was to negotiate with the Mask of Violence. Like, hey, you're violence, you know what this is for, you know how violence do, can you get me out of this?
Mm-hmm.
And violence's pledge on the other side of that was like, yeah, but you're going to need to hurt some people. And I'm like, oh, that is the thing you want in a story.
Yeah.
Like, I really, really appreciated that.
Yeah. And I go back and forth on that particular decision, because I'm not sure I drove it as home as I wanted to. The idea that violence wanted that character to commit more. That from violence's perspective, he wasn't as willing to get his hands dirty. And that's what violence wanted to see. Because a lot of the times the masks never want to trick you. They never want to lie to you. They never want to corrupt you. They just want you to go harder. They want to radicalize you further and, you know, kind of push you further. Sometimes then is strictly, you know, healthy. You know, I kind of deal with the issue of like burnout and, you know, the idea that sometimes the things we do or the roles we take on will push us to places that we don't, that are not sustainable in the long run. So like that's kind of the downside of the masks. Like they don't intend to do it any more than, you know, someone asking you to contribute to a cause or to come out and volunteer wants you to burn out. But it is by the nature of the work that if you do not have self-care and if you do not have a link within yourself of what you're capable of, the work will always push you forward. Sometimes you or your friends or your comrades need to pull yourself back.
Yeah. And the thing I really love about that is you talk about that burning you out. You talk about that as the ramifications of that being that you personally will be used up as almost as a resource, but not, and that will hurt the cause. So it's not, you know, and Bioshock Infinite style, oh no, they revolutioned too much kind of style. It's really, really good stuff. I really love the place your head's at when you're thinking about this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea is that, you know, people burning themselves out is never a good thing. Not that you'll bring down the entire cause if you need to take a break, you know?
Yeah. And indeed, that is, you know, that is like the fundamental, the fundamental difference between the vampire and the brigand in Brinkwood, mm-hmm. which is, you know, both of them say the human is the most precious resource.
Yeah.
But for one of them, it's the follow-up line is, and that's wonderful. And, like, there's a lot more stuff to talk about in there. There's stuff about how you've made it so that, like, being a vampire is a choice mm-hmm. rather than something imposed on you, like classic Lestat-style vampires. I know that you've made it so that characters can stop being a vampire, and being a vampire is something you maintain.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's a really good idea.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much more to have in this conversation. I'm a huge fan of this thing. I'm glad to see that the Kickstarter is succeeding, and I'm looking forward to getting my print-on-demand copy out here in the strange wild lands of Australia, mm-hmm. And everything that goes to that. But we have, however, consumed quite a bit of your time, and that is precious. So, if I may ask before you go, is there anything else that we should be keeping an eye out from the San Gennaro Co-op?
Yes, in fact. Obviously, there's the Brinkwood Kickstarter at brinkwood.net, but we also are releasing our fifth digest, which is kind of a collection of a lot of kind of shorter games, articles, just a lot of great content for anyone that's interested in tabletop role-playing games. It's currently, I think, available in print. You can get it if you go to @SanGennaroCoop on Twitter. And just follow the links from there. I think it's also on DriveThruRPG. That's definitely worth checking out. There's a lot of cool games inside that that you can, you know, literally go get out, pick up, and play right now. That's exciting.
Rad as hell. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'm so proud of everything you've done, and I don't mean that in like a paternalistic way. I mean, like, I look at the stuff that you've been doing and I'm just like so proud to be your friend. I'm so proud to know you. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to say thank you for sharing your time with me. Thank you for talking about Brinkwood, and I hope if you're listening to this that you go check it out. If you weren't interested, I hope that some of my enthusiasm for it is a little infectious.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward to talking to you more in the future about other stuff as well.
Of course. This is a lot of fun, and thank you for the time, and thank you for your enthusiasm. It really means a lot to me, and is a constant source of it stokes the engine that is often runs dry.
Oh, good. I'm often worried there's a certain degree of, like, you know, the open up Twitter. Oh, he's going off on Lovecraft again.
No.
Look, we're talking about the Oriental Adventures book. That's going to be fun.
No, it's always fun. It's always a joy to read, and it always gets my mind turning in one direction or another, where a lot of the times, sometimes I can go on Twitter and just kind of bum myself out. I appreciate having you as a friend and having your blog just as a resource for me to learn about stuff I didn't know about.
One final thing on that note, and just because like it's entirely possible that this whole conversation has gone by without anyone realizing this, there have been numerous times where Eric has disagreed with me, and indeed Eric has come to me and said, "This ain't it, Chief," and I have had to go, "Oh, damn, he's right." So like this is not just strictly like two white guys who already agree with one another, just happily saying how great they are. Like I have definitely had to have some humble moments.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's gone the other way too, where there have definitely been some things that I've needed to reconsider or think about a little more critically that you've pointed out to me, which I appreciate.
Anyway, as of always, Blink. You can go check out Brinkwood at brinkwood.net, and I look forward to talking to you next time, Eric.